Some very lovely gold work has been found in tombs there. And so they were involved in that sort of work. Here you see some lovely stone carving. And this is interesting because it shows us what the people look like in those times, way back in 2300 B.C., and quite possibly the patriarchs would have looked very much like these figures that you see on the right. So they had stonemasons. They were involved in stone cutting and in artwork. Here's a little closer view of some of these figures. On the left, they're just ordinary people. On the right, these are deities because they have a particular kind of a crown with some horns, and so they're probably gods. And then the furniture making, I mentioned that. We know they were involved in furniture making because of reference in some Mesopotamian documents about purchasing furniture from them. And so they were engaged in that work as well. Their number one industry, however, was textiles, and most of the documents have to do with the textile trade. And they carried their goods from their center there in northern Syria throughout the ancient world, clear down into Mesopotamia, over into Egypt, and north and east, and throughout the known world, and sold their goods. So they were primarily a commercial empire, not so much a military empire. Well, just a few words now about some of the things that have come out already from these tablets. The word, just in general, scholars at one time argued that a lot of words used in the Old Testament are very late, and that they were, centuries and centuries after the time of Moses before these words came into use. Therefore, the Bible, the Old Testament, was written late. Well, now these words are showing up at Ebla, 1,000 years before Moses. And one example is the word Tihon, which appears in the Enuma Elish story that we talked about. It's the word for the deep, the primordial waters. And we have the same word in Genesis 1-2. And that was one of the arguments for saying the biblical story came from the Babylonian account, because this word, the same word, is used. Well, now that word has been found in Ebla, already in 2300 B.C. It was just a common word of their language, and it cannot prove that the Bible was copied from a Babylonian creation story. There is a creation story that was found there at Ebla. It's the earliest known creation story. And it's much closer to our Genesis account than the Mesopotamian accounts that we've been talking about. In this account, the God simply speaks and something will come into being. Something will be formed or created. So it's very much like what we have in the Bible. And so this is one basis for saying then that the Bible gives us the original account, because the further back we go, the closer these extra-biblical accounts come to the Bible.
Yes, that story then.
There's a version of it published in the Biblical Archaeologist quite some years back in an article by Pettinato. I forget the exact year, but he did publish that story, that account. Canaan, the word Canaan, the name Canaan, was said to be an anachronism because scholars said it was a late word, it was a late name for that region, and so it was not used properly in the Bible. There was no place known as Canaan as early as the time of the patriarchs. Well, the people at Ebla weren't aware of that because they were doing business with somebody called the Canaanites over in Palestine. The word Canaan, the name Canaan, appears a number of times in the Ebla documents. And it's not an anachronism at all in the Old Testament. Well, this matter of the personal names. Here on the left are listed some of the names that are showing up in these Ebla documents. Eber, we've talked about, but the name Abraham, Ishmael, Esau, Israel, Saul, David, all of these names that are so familiar to us in the Old Testament are showing up there in the Ebla documents. Now, some scholars have said, well, these names in the Bible are not names of real people. They're tribes, or they're deities, or they're this or that. Well, at Ebla, they're real people. And so they're personal names, nothing more, nothing less. Again, showing the cultural connection between the patriarchs and that area of Ebla. A number of geographical lists have been found at Ebla. Probably these are trade routes that they followed. And familiar names from the Old Testament show up in these atlases. Names such as Hazor, Megiddo, Lachish, Jerusalem. The earliest mention of Jerusalem comes from these Ebla tablets. We'll talk about this next time, but even the names, not Gomorrah, but Sodom, the name Sodom has showed up, and one of the other cities of the plain, Adma, cross out Gomorrah. At first they thought Gomorrah was there, but it turns out it's not there, and Zoar is not there either, as far as I know. But Sodom and Adma do show up in one of these listings of places, and we'll talk about that after we come back after the holidays. Now, it's also showing us what life was really like in ancient times. In 1 Kings 10:14, we read that Solomon collected an enormous quantity of gold. It's usually given in terms of the Hebrew measure, and we don't really understand what it means in terms of our units today. But if you work it out, it's 20 tons of gold. Now, the objective person would say that's ridiculous. Solomon could never collect 20 tons of gold in 1 year. But when we begin to look at these ancient records, not only at Ebla, but in Egypt and other places, we see that the wealth was concentrated with the king, and they collected enormous quantities of precious metals. Just one example here at Ebla, one tribute payment from just one town was 5 tons of silver and 0.5 ton of gold. It was just one little payment. So you can imagine what the total wealth was for 1 year at Ebla. It would have far eclipsed Solomon's wealth. So these numbers that we read in the Old Testament of Solomon's wealth are not exaggerations when compared to contemporary figures from other cultures. Well, I think that's the end of our slides. And any questions? Yes?
What was the date on the tablets?
2400 to 2250 B.C. It should be on that handout. Yeah. Other questions? For a while, there was a lot in the news about Ebla and this discovery right after it was first made in the late 70s. But in recent years, there's been hardly anything written. And I think it's rather intentional because of all the publicity and the biblical connections. And the Syrian government did not like that at all, because in a way it's substantiating the history of the Israelites and the Israeli people. And the Syrians wanted to downplay that and emphasize their tradition and history and so on. And so they criticized Pettinato for his making these kinds of connections between the Bible and the Ebla tablets, and they've discouraged other scholars from drawing those kinds of connections. So that's unfortunate, but that's the situation we have. And the Italian archaeologist Mattier is more or less under the control of the Syrian government. If he doesn't go along with what they tell him, he doesn't dig, and so he pretty much does what they tell him. So now they have they continue their work, but they are de-emphasizing the biblical connections, unfortunately. But there's a wealth of information here for those who want to dig through the translated texts and ferret out these kinds of connections. I think there's a lot more that could be found there. Yes.
The correction, you say the archive of the 60,000 published
very small. I really don't know how many texts have been published, but there's four or five volumes have been put out, so it's probably a few hundred. And it's estimated that the total number of texts represented was 8,000 to 9,000. There's been, a lot of them are fragments and so on, so 8,000 or 9,000 complete texts represented, which is a lot of material. It's going to take decades and a long, long time before it's all published. But it's a very important find, and one I think that will give us a lot of information about the early patriarchal period. Well, okay, if there's no other questions, have a good holiday. Today we're going to be considering Abraham and some of his journeys and places he was. And also in the second hour we'll talk a bit about Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain. Abraham, of course, is one of the major figures of the Old Testament, a great example of faith. He is called the father of the chosen race. And he's not only the father of the Hebrew people, but he's the spiritual father of all believers. The wheels are turning. Ooh, be careful. So he's a very important character in biblical history, and so we want to examine some of the places where he lived. First of all, let's try to work out the date for Abraham and when exactly he lived. Well, we've talked about the date of the Exodus from Egypt and the fact that that really is a pivotal date, and you need to work that out before you can work out the chronology of the patriarchal period. So we begin with that date of 1450 B.C. is the date of the Exodus. And from there we can work our way backwards. So first of all, we go back to when Jacob and his family came into Egypt. So we need to add 430 years to take us back to 1880 B.C. And at that time, we're told, well, if you need a reference for the 430 years, that's Exodus 12:40. Tells us the Israelites were in the land of Egypt for a total of 430 years. Now, there's also another figure that you'll read of 400 years. And it's stated that the Israelites were in bondage for 400 years. So I interpret that to mean that they had 30 years where they lived free and did not have to work as Egyptian slaves. And then the bondage began, and they had another 400 years of bondage. There's other interpretations, but this is, it seems to me, the straightforward interpretation of these figures. When Jacob came in to Egypt, he was 130 years old, Genesis 47:9. Now, going back to when Jacob was born, we're told that Isaac, at that time, was 60 years old. So that takes us back to the birth of Isaac. And then when Isaac was born, we're told that Abraham was 100 years old. Isaac's age of 60 when Jacob was born is Genesis 25:26. And then Abraham's age of 100 when Isaac was born is Genesis 21:5. So this then should take us back to the birth of Abraham, if you're following all these figures. So when you add all this up, you come up with 2170 B.C. for the birth of Abraham. Yes. Yeah. 1450. Yes. Yes. No. It's plus or minus a few years. We can't be dogmatic about the exact date. But 1450 is a good round number. Now, this takes us back into the early Bronze Age. And I have no trouble with this dating. It looks pretty good to me, and we seem to have good correlations with our evidence for Abraham living in that time. Of course, if you go with the later date for the Exodus of 1270 or whatever, then you're in a different time period. This would change by about 200 years, roughly 200 years. And it would really bring Abraham into the Middle Bronze Age. I think he fits better at the end of the Early Bronze Age, myself. So that then would give us the birth date of Abraham. And further beyond that, we can work out some dates for his life based on the information given in Scripture. We're not entirely sure when he left Ur. That's a question mark. But we read in Genesis 11:26 is his birth to Terah. We read in 11:29-31 that he left Ur of the Chaldees with his father. At that time he was married, so he had to have been 20-ish, or who knows, perhaps older. But then we can calculate the date when he left Haran, because we're told that he was 75 years old, and so that would bring us to 2095 B.C., and that's Genesis 12:4, when he leaves Haran at age 75. So sometime previous to that, he left Ur of the Chaldees. We assume that Abraham was born in Ur, but that's not entirely certain either. All we can say is that he was there with his father when his father left. We're told that he was 86 when Ishmael was born. This is 16:16, so that would be 2084. Then we're told that he was 99 when the angels visited him at Mamre, and that's 1814. So that would be 2071. And at this time, the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. So this is a key date for us. And in fact, this would mark the end of the early Bronze III period, if my correlations are correct. So then we come into early Bronze IV. Of course, he was 100 then when Isaac was born. This is 21:5, 2070. He was 137 when Sarah died, 23:1-17, which would be the year 2033. And then he lived to the ripe old age of 175 in 1995 B.C. And that's in Genesis 25:7. And so the latter part of his life, then he's in early Bronze IV. So with this outline of the dates of his life, then we can look at the archaeological evidence and kind of fit Abraham in where he belongs. What kind of a person was Abraham? Well, we would call him a pastoral nomad, I think. we know quite a bit about these types of people because they're mentioned in the ancient text. The texts were largely written by the aristocracy of the city-states, and they were agriculturalists, industrialists, if you will. There was some amount of industry, manufacture in these urban centers. And then there was a large component of the population that was involved in sheep and goat raising and pursued pastoralism. And these folks traveled around. They didn't live in one particular location. They moved from place to place. So Abraham would be placed with that component of the population that was involved in the raising of sheep and donkeys and oxen and goats and so on. And that's clearly reflected in the biblical narrative because he moves around a good bit. Now, there is a dependency between the urban peoples and these pastoralists. There was a lot of friction, but also each depended upon the other. So these pastoralists had to be in the vicinity of urban centers, since they, in most time periods, did not farm themselves. They had to purchase their agricultural goods from the urban dwellers or the village dwellers. The urban people, the farmers, on the other hand, purchased meat and milk and many commodities from the pastoralists. So there was what we refer to as a symbiotic relationship between the two groups. So in the Abraham narrative, we read that Abraham goes from city to city to city. Now, he didn't live in the city, but he would live outside the city and trade with the folks that lived in the city. I think a good reflection of this relationship is in the story of Jacob, when he comes to Shechem. And there was the incident in Genesis 34 with the rape of Dinah. And then the men of Shechem wanted to live in peace with Jacob's family. And so they came to them and had a discussion at the end of chapter 34. And the chief, I guess you'd say, of the people there living at Shechem was Hamor. His son's name was Shechem, and evidently the city was named after his son. And so they spoke to Jacob and his family about living together. And of course, Jacob said, if all the male members of your clan and family will be circumcised, then that will be okay, and we can intermarry and live together and so on. And so Hamor goes to the city gate and talks to his fellow townsmen in verse 20 of Genesis 34. And he says, "These men are friendly towards us. Let them live in our land and trade in it. The land has plenty of room for them." Of course, they had their flocks and herds. They needed a lot of pastoral area. "We can marry their daughters and they can marry ours. But the men will consent to live with us as one people, only on the condition that our males be circumcised as they themselves are. Won't their livestock, their property, and all their other animals become ours? So let us give our consent to them, and they will settle among us." And so it would have been mutually beneficial to have these pastoralists living in their area, and they could trade and take advantage of each other's specialized products. So Abraham was that kind of a person. And he was a very wealthy man. These were not poor people, these pastoralists. I've had occasion to see this kind of a nomadic pastoralist in Egypt. And they're much better off than the villagers. They are very well-to-do. Probably somewhere along the line, I'll show you some slides of those folks over there in Egypt. References in Genesis 12, 16, 13, 2, and 6 indicate that Abraham was very wealthy, and Lot, his nephew, who was traveling with him when they got into Canaan, was also very wealthy. They had such extensive flocks and herds that they had to separate because the land could not support so many in one localized area. So they had to separate and go their different ways. And then over in Genesis 14, verse 14, we read that Abraham had 318 trained servants when he went to rescue Lot. These were servants born in his household. So we're talking about a very well-to-do pastoralist here. Why they were in Ur, we're not told. It seems that the homeland of the patriarchs of Haran, Terah, and the early patriarchs was up around the city of Haran and in Padan Aram. Now it could be that Terah was simply in Ur for business purposes. He might have had a good trade going there with the citizens of Ur. We just don't know. But when they left and they came up to Haran and spent some time there until Terah died, and then Abraham left Haran and came into Canaan following God's call. Well, let's begin with Ur of the Chaldees. Yes, question. Yes. 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 We'll talk about that next class when we'll talk about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah.
So this is correct.
Yes. Yes.
Correct.
Yes. They're both correct. The problem is a big uncertainty in those archaeological dates. I think the biblical dating is more precise, and we'll get into that next hour. Okay. Well, let's travel to Ur of Chaldees. Ur is located in modern-day Iraq. It's 220 miles south of Baghdad. And originally, it was on the Persian Gulf. But now the Persian Gulf has silted up over the centuries, and it's located some 6 miles or so from the shoreline of the Persian Gulf. It looks like it's inland, but when it was in its heyday, in Abraham's day, it was really a port city and a very prosperous, thriving city at that time. Ur was one of the cities of Sumer, the first civilization that we know anything about. Sumer is mentioned in the Bible. Genesis 10:10 mentions the early cities of Sumer. And here in Genesis, it's called Shinar. But in chapter 10, verse 10, we read about Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And he established cities of Babylon, Erech. Now, Erech is known as Uruk in the Mesopotamian references. Akkad, which is Agad in the Mesopotamian literature, and Kalna. And these were in Shinar, or southern Babylonia, or ancient Sumer. And then in chapter 11, again, we have a reference to Shinar. This is the account of the building of the Tower of Babel. It begins, now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, or Sumer and settle there. And then we have the story of the Tower of Babel. So Ur was one of the cities in Sumer. Our first writing comes from Sumer, from this culture, and goes back to about 3300 BC. And it seems, in fact, that writing was developed there in southern Mesopotamia, because Egyptians did not have writing until about 3100 BC. So it seems that it began there in Sumer and then spread over to Egypt. On the handout, I have a brief history of Ur, the various periods of occupation. As opposed to Palestine, they don't go by early bronze and middle bronze and all of that, because they have a very complete history in Mesopotamia, in Egypt as well. So they can refer to historical periods, and they have the names of the kings who ruled during these periods, and they have fairly accurate dates worked out. So they don't need to resort to this crazy 3H system that we use in Palestine. In Palestine, when we get to back into the Canaanite period, we cannot construct a very good history of the region. Yes, question? What evidence? The written material. 3200 or 3300, along in there, yes. The evolution of writing has been worked out now, and we can put its beginnings at right around 3300 or 3200. The very earliest writing is a picture writing, and then from that they developed symbols. And it was a very complex system, because they had thousands of these symbols to stand for various objects or sounds. And it was very, very complex. And the alphabet wasn't developed till much later. And it was a much simpler system. The very earliest writing we cannot read as of yet. But very soon the Sumerians developed the writing quite extensively, and we can read the Sumerian writing, but the forerunner, the picture writing, which was the very beginning of writing, we cannot read that. So, as far as we know, writing began there in Sumer, in this area around Ur. So, in looking at our chronological chart there, we could place Abraham in this Akkadian and Guti period, or possibly at the beginning of the third dynasty of Ur. Now, these dates have quite a large plus or minus factor on them. The further back you go, the more uncertain we are about these dates. But somewhere in that time period, Abraham would have lived here at Ur. The major excavation work done at Ur was conducted by Sir Leonard Woolley. This was back between 1922 and 1934. This was a joint expedition of the British Museum and the University Museum here at the University of Pennsylvania. There were some minor excavations prior to that, but not too much came out of those excavations, but this was a long, major excavation, and they recovered a lot of material from Ur. Ur in the Bible is referred to as Ur of the Chaldees. Now, the name Ur simply means city. Some have argued that the Ur that Abraham came out of is somewhere else. It's not this particular Ur. But it seems with that clarification, Ur of the Chaldees, it has to be this Ur, because the Chaldees is the area of southern Mesopotamia. Some have tried to make a case that Ur was much further north, closer to Haran, and that Abraham did not have a long journey to go from Ur to Haran. It was just a little short distance. Well, there is a place called Ur up there, but that's not the area of the Chaldees. The Chaldees is further south. So I think most scholars would hold that the Ur of southern Mesopotamia is the Ur of the Bible, Ur of the Chaldees. Let's take a look at what has been excavated there. The city, as I mentioned, was originally on the Persian Gulf, and it was a port city. So on the north side of the city and also on the west, there were docks and warehouses and so on for river traffic. Of course, it was located right on the Euphrates River, right where the river flowed into the Persian Gulf. So there was a harbor there, and they would load and unload the boats here at Ur at these harbor facilities. We have up at the northern end here a sacred area, right here. And then around that sacred area there were dwellings, and these come from the Isin-Larsa period. The sacred area that has been excavated is the area that was built by Ur-Nammu, the king Ur-Nammu, who ruled around 2100 B.C. It was later restored in the Neo-Babylonian period by Nabonidus, but the original construction of most of it goes back to around the time of Abraham, around 2100 B.C. This sacred area is quite interesting. We have, first of all, a large enclosure wall here surrounding the sacred area. Inside of that were various structures, probably used by the priests and religious personnel. There was another sort of enclosed area here, just to the northeast of the great ziggurat. Of course, the ziggurat was sort of the most sacred and the holiest area of this sacred area. But in this enclosed area here to the northeast, there were rooms all around, sort of a courtyard, and again, they were used for storage and cooking and so on. There's various storage facilities also here in this area just to the east of the ziggurat. It's difficult to tell exactly how these various buildings were used, but in the buildings where there's these long, narrow rooms, it's normally thought that they were used for storage purposes. The temple tower, the ziggurat here, was in the center of its sort of sacred enclosure, and it was a stepped tower with a temple on the top. And undoubtedly, the story in Genesis about the Tower of Babel is the story of the construction of one of these sacred towers, or ziggurats, as they're called. The one in the Bible is undoubtedly the one at Babylon. There are many of these ziggurats in the ancient sites throughout Mesopotamia. The one here at Ur is the best preserved of all of the ziggurats, so it gives us a good idea of how these towers were constructed. The inner core of this structure was made of unbaked mud bricks. The outer surfaces, the outer shell, so to speak, was made of fired bricks, so that it was very hard and would hold up to the elements. The quality of construction is shown by the fact that it's still standing today, by and large. I mean, it's kind of disintegrated somewhat, but it's basically all there, and it's been pretty much restored now by the government of Iraq. The mortar that was used for these bricks was bitumen. And again, this correlates with that story in Genesis about building the tower, because it tells us that they used bricks to build the tower, and for mortar they used slime. It's sometimes translated, there's different translations, but it's basically this bitumen material, kind of an asphalt-like substance, tarry type of substance, which was naturally occurring in that area. Also, we find it around the Dead Sea. So this temple tower at Ur was constructed as exactly as described in the Bible of the Tower of Babel. There were three massive steps, and on the top of the third step was the temple. And it was dedicated to the moon god Nannar. N-A-N-N-A or N-A-N-N-A-R. Sometimes there's an R on it, sometimes the R is left on. There were three different stairways on different sides that led up to a sort of a gate room on the first level, the first stage, and then from there smaller stairs went up to the second and third stages. We also have some temples around that sacred ziggurat, in addition to the temple of the moon god on top of the ziggurat. We have here to the northeast Nannar Temple, it's called, with its sort of a courtyard and rooms around the outside. And then to the east, there's a palace here of Ur-Nammu, the one who's credited with most of the construction work. Tombs, and these are extremely interesting. We have in this area a royal cemetery, and there were various mausoleums found, and then under the mausoleums was an older cemetery. The mausoleums that were found date to the third dynasty of Ur, and these were structures made of baked bricks, again with bitumen used for mortar, and they were built more or less like a private house. Of course, this was to be the eternal resting place, and so they built it as they would build a home. It had some aspects of a temple, because these are for the rulers, these great burials. The ruler was considered to be a god, and so when he was laid to rest, he was laid to rest in a royal house. So it had some aspects of a temple, some aspects of a private home. They found below the floors of the rooms in the back of the buildings brick stairways leading to underground tomb chambers, and that's where the actual burial was made. Unfortunately, all of these buildings and the tombs had been plundered and robbed in antiquity, so there was practically nothing left. But underneath these mausoleums, there was an older cemetery, and this dated to the middle of the early dynastic period, somewhere around 2600 BC or so. These are referred to many times as the royal death pits. Now, this goes back somewhat before the time of Abraham, but I think it gives us a good indication of the riches, the wealth that was there in Ur of the Chaldees. There was a great wealth of treasure buried here
in these royal death pits, gold and kind of precious stones, and all kinds of things were recovered. They found that servants and warriors were buried with the dead king. Evidently, these people took poison at the time the king was buried so that they could go with him into the afterlife. There were soldiers guarding the king. There were musicians at the harp playing, a chariot with the driver and so on. Everything there that he would need in the afterlife. And we find references to this sort of thing in some of the literary texts where it speaks about the servants, the retinue, following the ruler into the afterlife. The private houses found around the sacred area give us a glimpse into everyday life. The private homes were two stories high. The streets, of course, were very narrow, but it was laid out, and much like a modern town would be laid out today. Some of the houses had indoor plumbing, not running water as such, but they had indoor toilets, indoor bathing facilities, and so they would carry the water in and use it inside. We find that the people of Ur were very advanced in science and mathematics and all kinds of fields. We know this from the clay tablets that were found there. In mathematics, for example, they could take a square root, they could calculate a cube root, and one of my favorites is calculating the relationship between the sides of a right-angled triangle. You remember from your mathematics day, C squared equals A squared plus B squared. Now, we call that the Pythagorean theorem from the Greek Pythagoras, who everybody thought developed that particular formula. He lived, I don't know, 500 BC or 400 BC or something. But we find that very same formula on a clay tablet at Ur of the Chaldees going back to the times of Abraham. It's all diagrammed and all explained on a clay tablet. So they had knowledge of mathematics in those days. Art was very advanced. They were very good at metalworking, for example, working with gold. They were very advanced in metallurgy. In fact, some of the metallurgical procedures that they had in southern Mesopotamia at that time were later lost and were not rediscovered until 100 years ago or so in modern times, the combining of certain metals. They were quite advanced in astronomy, in the sciences. They had their physicians and doctors and so on. Abraham did not come out of a primitive culture. It was a very advanced culture. They had business and banking and so on as we have today. So this is the kind of a background that Abraham came out of when he left Ur of the Chaldees. He was not an ignorant nomad. In fact, Abraham is able to do business with several different ethnic and national groups, the Hittites and the Egyptians and the Canaanites. So whether or not Abraham himself could speak these languages, at least somebody that worked for him could translate. And Abraham would have had to have had scribes to keep all of his records of his business dealings and so on. So it would not be unexpected that he would keep a record of his own personal history of leaving Ur and all the events that happened to him. So I have no trouble with the concept that the patriarchs wrote down their own personal history on clay tablets as it happened. Now going on to Haran, where Abraham spent some time until his father's death, Haran is located in southern Turkey. There has been some amount of archaeological work there, but very little. So we just don't have a lot of information from Haran. There's a modern town there today, so it's somewhat limited as to what can be done there. So we don't have too much information about Haran. But now coming down into Canaan, when Abraham left Haran, he came down to Shechem. And Shechem has been excavated, and we do know a fair bit about the city of Shechem. It's located in the northern part of the central hill country between Mount Gerizim on the south and Mount Ebal on the north. It's kind of a strategic location. Here you see Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal there. And so it's at this very narrow pass between those mountains. The name Shechem in Hebrew means shoulder, and some have said that it was called Shechem because it's built on a little shoulder that kind of overlooks the valley in that area. But we read in Genesis 33 and 34 about Shechem, the son of Hamor. So I rather think it was named after this individual rather than after the Hebrew word for shoulder. It was excavated by the Germans on and off between 1913 and 1934, but little useful information came out of that, unfortunately, because their methodology was so poor. An American excavation was undertaken there between 1956 and 1968. This was sponsored by the American Schools of Oriental Research and a sort of a consortium of different seminaries. One of them was the seminary at Harvard University. It was under the direction of G. Ernest Wright, a student of W.F. Albright. And at that excavation, he trained a whole generation of Palestinian archaeologists. So it was an important dig, not only for what they recovered concerning the history of Shechem, but also as a training ground for future archaeologists. At that time, Kenyon was excavating at Jericho, and she was using the stratigraphic method of excavation, where you very carefully peel away phase after phase and slowly go down through the material. This was kind of a new concept in Palestinian archaeology. She paid very close attention to the vertical sides of the excavation area, the balk, as it's called. And so that was drawn in great detail and analyzed in great detail to give you a history of the area you were excavating. Wright used these methods at Shechem and developed them and really taught them to other North American archaeologists. And then from there, other excavations used these techniques and methods. So Shechem was kind of a training ground for Palestinian archaeologists from North America. They found a large Middle Bronze city there. About half of the site could be excavated. The other half had a village on it, the village of Balata, and so they couldn't dig there. So we've got the northern half, basically, of ancient Shechem. And you can see there was a city wall around the outside. There was a gate up here in the northwest, as well as another gate over here on the east. The city was founded in the Middle Bronze I period, right around 1900 BC. And this is the time of Jacob, when Jacob was dealing with Hamor and Shechem in Genesis 33 and 34. And so that seems to be the city that was founded by this person, Shechem. Now, of course, Abraham was there much earlier. And probably at that time it was nothing more than a campsite of some sort, perhaps a sacred area there. But there, as far as we can tell from the archaeology, there was no city as such at that time. The interesting thing about Shechem is the sacred area, which is over here on the northwest side. There's a great temple there, a great sacred stone that was found. And this sacred area is mentioned a number of times in Scripture. We have the reference in the story of Abraham, and then later in the times of Joshua. They renewed the covenant there, and it's referred to over in the book of Judges as well. And there always seems to be a temple, a sacred tree, and a sacred stone pillar mentioned. And it seems, from what's been found, that this is the area that's referred to here, because there's a temple there, and a sacred stone was found, and possibly there was a sacred tree there in antiquity. Abraham came on from Shechem down to the area of Bethel and Ai. We're told he pitched his tent on a hill between Bethel and Ai. He built an altar there and sacrificed to the Lord. These two locations are a bit controversial, and we won't say too much about them at this point, because when we get to the conquest and the capture of Ai by Joshua and the Israelites, we can go into a little more detail on Ai and the problem of Ai and where it might be located. So we'll just sort of leave that hanging for the moment. We know generally the area where this event took place, although there's some controversy about the exact precise location. So I think that's enough on Abraham and his travels. He came down and lived at Mamre, which is near Hebron, down in the southern part of Canaan. Here again, we don't have a lot of archaeological information from Hebron. There's been a little bit of digging in that area, but not enough to uncover any part of the ancient city. So we just don't know too much about this area, archaeologically speaking. We know where it was located and where Abraham lived, but we don't have any archaeological details from that area. So let's take a break till 4, and then we'll come back and talk about Sodom and Gomorrah. On the handouts, you'll notice there's a chronological chart there for the occupational phases at Bab Edra. This is the northernmost site that you see located there on the map up at the Lisan Peninsula. This was the first of these five sites to be excavated. All five of these places indicated on the map there, Bab Edra, Numira, Safi, Fifi, Kanazir, are early Bronze Age sites. And they seem to fit the biblical description of the cities of the plain. We know that there were five cities of the plain, the most famous of which was Sodom, Gomorrah as well. So we talk about Sodom and Gomorrah, but these were only two of five cities. We also have Zoar, Adma, and Zeboiim. And the scripture references for the cities of the plain are given there in Hinnah 13, 10 to 13, and chapters 14, 18, and 19 of Genesis. The archaeological work in this region goes back actually to W.F. Albright in the 1920s. He investigated this area looking for Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain. He was unsuccessful, he thought. He did locate this site of Bab Edra. Bab Edra is Arabic for gate of the arm. And he thought that this was simply a burial ground because there's an enormous cemetery located there. He also found some standing stones that he thought were sacred objects. And so his interpretation was that this was simply a cultic center, a burial site where people came from that region to bury their dead. And his idea was, his theory, was that the cities of the plain were located down in the valley, this Gor area that's indicated on your map, in the area of the southern basin of the Dead Sea, and that the sites were covered over by the water of the southern basin of the Dead Sea, and that probably they would never be discovered. And he believed that the people that lived in those cities down in the valley would come up to this site of Bab Adra, which is a little above the valley, up on a little bluff overlooking the plain below. They'd bring their dead up there to bury them, and they would come up there for religious ceremonies, and that was the significance of the site of Bab Adra. In the early 1960s, pottery began showing up on the antiquities market in Amman, Jordan, from the early Bronze period. Beautiful, complete vessels. And it was obvious that there was some clandestine digging going on that someone had found an early Bronze Age cemetery, and they were looting the tombs and then selling the vessels on the antiquities market. So the archaeologists that noted this began to check into where these vessels were coming from, and they discovered that they were coming from the cemetery here at Bab Adra. So an expedition was organized in the mid-60s to excavate the site before it was totally looted and plundered, and there'd be nothing left for the archaeologists to excavate. So a man by the name of Paul Lapp headed up the work there at Bab Adra, and he excavated up until 1969. He wrote a couple of articles on his findings. He spent most of the time in the cemetery, but he did some work in the little town site. There was a small town site there. In 1969, he was tragically drowned off the coast of Cyprus, and so he was not able to complete the work. And it fell to two younger scholars who had worked with him there, Thomas Schaub and Walter Rast. And so the job of publishing the material fell to these two young PhD students. And they felt that they really couldn't explain this enormous cemetery that was there at Bab Adra. It had thousands of burials in it. And so the first thing they did was to conduct a survey of the area to look for other sites that perhaps were using that cemetery. And in the summer of 1973, they did the survey, and they located these other four sites to the south that are shown there on the plan. Well, this was quite an eye-opener, because now, rather than the one site to deal with, they had four others, and the sites seemed to be connected some way. They were all located along the edge of the valley, as you see there, and they were all from the same time period. They all seemed to have been destroyed at about the same time. So they, at that point, reorganized themselves and established what they called the expedition to the Dead Sea, I think is the name of it. But the purpose of this new undertaking is to investigate all of the sites, not just Bab Adra, but all of the sites. And that work is still going on today. They began in 1975, I believe, and they've been going into the field every other year, every odd year. And I think that is still the plan. And they've been publishing their material slowly and continuing their work. As far as I know, They haven't excavated beyond Numira. I haven't heard anything about any work at Safi. There was a little bit of work at Fifa, I think, just a very short season, and nothing at Kanazir. So the work is still ongoing. Now, the occupational phases that you have on the chart, this is for Babadra. This is the site we know most about because it's the one that's received the most attention. And Lap worked there a number of seasons, and then Rast and Shab worked there for a number of seasons. So we have the occupational phases for Babadra fairly well worked out. And so that's what I have on the chart, is the various periods and the dating assigned to those periods by the archaeologists working at the site, by Rast and Shab. So we have a pre-urban phase, and at this time they used shaft tombs and disarticulated burials. In other words, not complete skeletons were buried in these tombs, but a pile of bones, basically, a skull and a pile of bones was buried. So evidently the skeleton was left exposed until the flesh was gone. The bones were gathered up and then buried in these shaft tombs. The shaft tombs are simply a shaft dug into the ground and then chambers dug out from that shaft. There might be one chamber, two chambers, three chambers, as many as four chambers off of the one shaft. Then we come into the urban phase around 3100 BC, and at this time they used charnel houses for their burials. These were structures built on top of the ground where they would just, again, bring in the disarticulated skeleton and place it in the charnel house. This urban phase was the phase where there was a city wall built around this small town, and it lasted for quite a few centuries, from about 3100 BC down to its destruction, which they date at 2350. And then after that, there was a post-urban phase where there was still some occupation around the ruins there at Babadra, the EB4 period, for another couple of hundred years. And during this phase, they went back to the use of the shaft tombs. And now we have, for the first time, articulated. Now, excuse me, in the charnel houses, we had articulated. Complete skeletons. Okay. The problem now of the dating and trying to correlate this with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah that we read about in the days of Abraham in the Bible. The correlation between these sites and the description given in the Bible is so strong, I think we have to make that correlation, that this destruction of these cities is the destruction mentioned in the Bible. Everything fits. The only difficulty is the date. Now, we worked out a date of 2070, was it, for the destruction? 2071 for the destruction according to biblical chronology. Now, that's assuming, of course, that we have complete records there. There's no gaps in the biblical record. There could, I suppose, be some gap in there, something that was left out of the biblical genealogy or biblical history that would put Abraham earlier. I don't think so. I think our records from Abraham on are complete. I think the problem is with the archaeological dates. These dates for the early Bronze Age are very, very approximate. We don't know these within probably 300 years. Egyptian history at this time is only known within about 200 years, and then to correlate that with something over in Palestine, you're adding an additional uncertainty, so that these dates are just very approximate. You'll read different dates in different books and different articles, and that just shows that we really don't have a good fix on these dates. Every archaeologist dealing with this period will put a different number with these periods. Now, everybody's pretty much in agreement, I think, on the EB 1, 2, and 3, 4 sequence, but exactly when you date those periods is a matter of some disagreement amongst scholars. Now, the tendency with archaeological dates has been, as you get more information and more data, and you can be more precise with your dates, the dates tend to come down. They tend to be lowered. And so I fully expect that's what will happen with these dates when we do get some evidence that will help us to be more accurate. I think they will probably come down. And so I have no hesitation making the correlation between the biblical event of the destruction of the cities of the plain and the destruction of Babadra and these other sites at the end of Early Bronze 3. That fits Abraham very nicely, not only here, but the site of Ai as well. And we'll get into that when we talk about Ai when we get to the conquest. So that's why there's a discrepancy. These are the archaeological dates that the archaeologists have come up with. Very rough, very approximate, but it's what they use, and so that's what I put here on the chart. The date that we came up with from the Bible is very, very precise, and I would say is the more accurate date, and I believe in the end will be found to be the correct date for the destruction of these sites and the correct date for the end of Early Bronze 3. Time will tell. We will have to wait and see on that one. Okay, well, that's a quick introduction. I have some slides to show you.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What's the implication if we use the dating of the Bible 2070 and say that it is before 1640 rather than 1660?
Well, the implication is that you don't have this nice connection between the destruction of the cities of the plain and the end of the Early Bronze 3 period and the destruction there at the other sites. It throws you off. That can be a problem. Genesis 13. Now from the map you can see why these sites would be called the cities of the plain. They're located right along the edge of this great valley in Arabic called the Gor. And there's good evidence that the southern basin of the Dead Sea was not there in Abraham's day. This was something later as the Dead Sea rose. Then it spilled over into this valley area. That southern basin was always just a very shallow area. The northern part of the Dead Sea is very, very deep. I meant to point out when I was talking about Albright and his theory about the cities being down in that valley beneath the waters of the southern basin of the Dead Sea. That southern basin is not there today. It's gone because the level of the Dead Sea has dropped in the past 10 years or so because both on the Jordanian side and on the Israeli side of the Jordan Valley, they're both taking water from the Jordan River to irrigate the Jordan Valley. So there's less water flowing into the Dead Sea. Of course, they've had a very severe drought, too, in the last few years in Israel. But even before the drought, there was basically no southern basin. There is still water in that area because they extract minerals from the waters of the Dead Sea down in this area. And they have built a canal that brings the water from the northern part down into some large basins, tanks, where they evaporate out the minerals, potash and other minerals from the waters of the Dead Sea. So when you go there, you'll see some water, and don't say, hey, Dr. Whitson, there's no water there, and there's some water. That water has been directed in there through this canal, but the natural basin has dried up. As a result of that, we know there are no ruins at all in that area that was formerly that southern basin of the Dead Sea. The whole area has been investigated by the company that's doing the mineral work down there, the Potash Company. They went over this whole area with hovercraft, because when they first went out there, it was very muddy and so on. But they were able to go over this whole area, and there's no ruins at all. So Albright's theory has proven to be incorrect. In fact, it wasn't a good theory to begin with, because this was the agricultural area, and you wouldn't build your towns and your cemeteries in your agricultural fields. You'd build them back up away. It was cooler, for one thing. It was a bit higher. They were exposed to the breezes up there, a little above the plain. And they could protect themselves better if they were built. They built their city up on a little hill or shoulder or something. So it never was a good theory. I guess the reason I started telling you all this about Albright is that you will still read this theory in many encyclopedias and Bible handbooks. But it's totally been disproven now. And these five sites that we're talking about here fit the biblical description much better as the cities of the plain. So here's the first reference, Genesis 13:10, when Abraham and Lot had to go their separate ways. And Abraham gave Lot the choice of the land. While Lot lifted up his eyes, and he looked eastward to the plain, the Kirkar, the valley, the round, the flat valley of Jordan, and he saw that it was well watered everywhere. Now here the Hebrew indicates intense irrigation. And this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, and it was like the garden of the Lord, like the Garden of Eden. So this is Lot's description, or the description given of what Lot saw. He's looking towards Sodom and Gomorrah. He sees that it's well irrigated, well watered everywhere. It was a very lush, green area, very desirable area to live in. So then in verse 12, we're told that Abraham stayed on the west side of the Jordan River in Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain. And he pitched his tents near Sodom, and we're told the men of Sodom were wicked and sinning greatly against the Lord. Now, the Hebrew construction here is very interesting. These are cities of the plain, cities of the plain with the wow consecutive, I think, is the precise construction. They're not cities in the plain or on the plain. They're cities very closely associated with the plain. And I think this location that we see of these sites explains the situation. They were located adjacent to that plain, and that plain is where they had their agricultural fields. They irrigated that plain. Each of these sites is located next to a perennial stream that comes down from the Transjordanian Plateau, flows out into the gore, the plain, the valley area. So each city could then control the waters coming from that stream in an irrigation system in front of their city. And that would be their area of responsibility and the area where they grew their crops. So their life was dependent upon this plain, this agricultural area where they grew their foodstuffs. Now we're told that the men were exceedingly wicked, and of course the story of the angels going in to warn Lot tells us about this great wickedness and sinfulness, and because of this wickedness, God destroyed these places. They then become examples throughout the rest of the Bible of God's judgment of sin. Even in our culture today, we still have remnants of this story in our tradition. We talk about a place being as wicked as Sodom and Gomorrah. We have the legal term sodomy in our legal parlance, and of course this goes harks back to the unnatural sex acts there at Sodom. We speak about a preacher preaching fire and brimstone. Well, again, this is referring back to that great destruction that came down from heaven and fell upon these cities. Okay, so Lot then moved over and lived at Sodom. You have the map that gives the location. It's right here along the eastern side of the former southern basin of the Dead Sea. Now, the Jordan Valley, the Dead Sea, the Araba here south of the Dead Sea, this is all part of the Great Rift. And it begins up in Syria, comes down through central Palestine and down into Africa. And down here it's called the Great Rift. But here at the Dead Sea, it's simply part of that system where the crust of the earth has settled down, and it's a very low point. In fact, the Dead Sea is the lowest place on the face of the earth. And the water flows in, but none flows out. And because of that fact, the Dead Sea is full of chemicals, minerals, and so on. And if you go in the water there, you just pop right up to the surface like a cork. It's practically impossible to go under the water. Here's the map that's on your handout, so we don't need to talk about that. I mentioned the survey of 1973 by Rast and Schaub when they found these additional four sites. At that time, they suggested that perhaps these were the cities of the plain mentioned in the book of Genesis. Of course, they have kind of a warped interpretation. They think that the biblical stories are later reflections of some earlier event. They do not have the view that the Bible gives us an eyewitness account of the destruction and of the events that took place there. On the left is a view, an aerial view, of that southern basin before it was dried up. You see the Lasan Peninsula on the left, and it gives you kind of an idea of the landscape. You see over to the extreme left there, to the east, the mountains of Moab coming right down to the southern basin there, and then the flat plain area to the west of that. On the right is just a schematic cross-section showing the great depth of the northern part of the Dead Sea compared to that shallower basin. And in this sketch, it shows ruins of cities beneath the waters of that basin, but that is not true at all. Now, on the left, we have a view from the west side near Masada, looking across the Lasan over to where Bab Adra is located at the head of the Lasan. You can see the mountains there of Moab and of Transjordan in the background. And on the right, that very same view taken a couple of years ago. And you can now walk across that area of the Lasan because there's no water there. And over to the right, it's all dry, except for these evaporation tanks clear over to the right here. And you can see the canal that's running along here to bring the water over into that evaporation basin there. So the waters have dropped, and I believe in Abraham's day, there was no southern basin. That was all agricultural area. And in the description of the battle between the kings of Mesopotamia and the kings of the cities of the plain, it talks about them fighting in this very area of the southern basin of the Dead Sea. Well, on the left is a view from above coming down toward the Lasan Peninsula. And the site of Bab Adra is located here, right on the edge of the Wadi Karak, it's called. And the ruins are located here. And on the right is a plan of Bab Adra. You can see the city wall that went around the site. It's not a very large place. And as I mentioned, Rast and Shab had difficulty understanding why the cemetery was so vast and yet the town site was so small. It seems that the town site is really just kind of a fortified enclosure where the king and the officials live, and that most of the people lived outside the town walls in the surrounding region. In time of war, they could all come into the city and be protected by the city walls, but normally it seems that most people lived outside, because this cemetery had tens of thousands of burials, indicating a very large population. Not only that, but as Rast and Shab discovered these other sites, they found two other cemeteries, just as large or larger than the one at Babadrab. So it's very clear that in the early Bronze Age period, this region had a very large population. You would never guess it today. It's a very dry, looks like a lunar landscape in this area. If you were to irrigate the valley, however, it is a very productive place for growing crops. It's not done today because that valley is actually the border.